Operation Epic Fury is paused as the U.S. and Iran enter a two-week conditional ceasefire. Will it hold? Dr. Waleed Faraz is here with analysis. And Catholic League President Bill Donahue takes a closer look at a Netflix series that is going viral for defaming the Pope. And Pope Leo heads to Africa for a 10-day journey. What will be the focus of the trip? The National Catholic Register's senior Vatican correspondent Ed Penton joins us with a preview. Bioethicist Father Tad Paholczyk reacts to the latest news on assisted suicide, cloning, and much more. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over as we celebrate our 30th year. We've got a great show for you this evening, and if you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. This week, the U.S., Israel, and Iran have reached what's being described as a limited two-week ceasefire following 32 days of Operation Epic Fury. What should we expect to happen next? And will diplomacy be enough to hold the ceasefire together? With analysis, I'm joined by Middle East policy expert Dr. Waleed Faraz, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast. Waleed, this operation is a month old now. Estimates put the combined death toll somewhere around 3,500. Iran shut down the Strait of Hormuz, and U.S. gas prices here have crossed $4 a gallon for the first time since 2022. Will this two-week ceasefire hold, and what is the goal here?
First of all, will it hold? It depends really this time on the Islamic regime in Iran, because they are the ones who sought this engagement, because they know and they saw that the combined power of the United States and of Israel at the same time took out most of the strategic arms of that regime. No Navy, no Air Force, 80% of the ballistic is gone, 60 to 70% of the first level leaders of the Islamic regime are gone, in addition to, of course, the credibility of the Islamic Republic. So what they're trying to do, that's the Khomeinis, whomever is calling the shots on the inside of the IRGC, is to gain time. If time to be gained is done through negotiations, they will. But it's not going to be an easy negotiation.
Just days before this ceasefire, I mean, we were, I guess, on the brink of what can only be described as Armageddon. I mean, President Trump posted on Trump Social, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, never to be brought back again, end quote. He had told reporters the day before that he was prepared to destroy Iran's civilian power plants and bridges if no deal was reached. When you heard those words, what went through your mind and the minds of the Iranian people, do you think?
In my own mind, I knew what he meant. He meant not the Iranian-Persian historical civilization. He meant the jihadists. He meant their caliphate. He meant basically the Khomeinist Islamist regime. They would be gone forever. That's his threat. Second, with regard to the population, he already has told the Iranians, let's remember, you and I spoke about it a few weeks ago. Go to the streets, seize your institutions, and even fight back. So it is clear to me that he wants the people to be saved, the regime to be destroyed. Now, of course, he put it in a dramatic way, as he does all the time. Right. But the Iranian people, despite what he said, the actual Iranian people, they want him to do anything he can to save them.
Do you think that what some would call reckless language, that that actually brought them to the negotiating table in a way they might not have otherwise?
What brought them to the negotiating table is the effects of his powerful military. It's Pete Hegseth and our intelligence communities who destroyed basically what the regime can use. That convinced them. And they did math, real math. The combination between the U.S. and Netanyahu's government in Lebanon against Hezbollah, that means the end of their civilization. So they wanted to stop it, to slow it, to negotiate, but they're not going to actually go where the president wants them to go. That's my pronostic.
Uh-huh. Before I get to my next question about negotiations, who is the U.S. really dealing with here, Waleed? And how credible are these people who are allegedly the Iranian leadership?
Where the Iranian leadership, meaning the Khomeinists, come from is a combo of the IRGC, meaning the heads of the militias, the head of the SS in World War II language, but also you have the people of the money, the billionaires, the trillionaires inside the regime. Remember, this is a regime that has been making a lot of money from the Obama years, Iran deal, and the Biden years. A lot of money came in. So they are in discussions, internal discussions among each other to see how to approach the Trump administration and how to make sure that the Israelis are not going to continue their action against Hezbollah.
Hmm. Iran's foreign minister told Al Jazeera that he's been in communication with Steve Witkoff, who's the president's representative here, but that Iran has no faith that negotiations with the U.S. will yield results. The Iranian president told the European Council president that Iran has the will to end the war, but needs guarantees. Waleed, how will diplomacy now work? And what are Tehran's non-negotiable conditions?
You and I have used a term, and I explained it many times over the years, called taqiya, which is a ruse, which is basically a camouflage. And the Khomeinist ideology, you know, legitimized that term, meaning, in other words, they lie. They tell their own people that they're not going to make concessions so that they are still with them and, you know, do not go away. They tell the Europeans, oh, it's the fault of the Trump administration. They're not serious. And then they tell the Trump administration through these envoys, and I would even say those go in between the brokers, that, they are serious. They will offer the president, but they have to tell something to their public. So the bottom line, we go back to square one, Raymond. It's time. They want to buy time. They'll do anything to buy time, even trying to convince their foes, us, that they are serious, but then telling their own people, the militias, that this is just a tactic.
Yeah, interestingly enough, Israel insisted that Lebanon be carved out of the ceasefire, Waleed. Why is that? And what has Netanyahu gained by keeping that front open and continuing Israeli strikes there?
Well, the question is, Raymond, why would a regime, an Islamist regime, at 1,000 kilometers away, want to get involved in an operation that has nothing to do with Iran in Lebanon? Because that could go also true to be true with the Houthis in Yemen. So if the Israelis accept not to go after Hezbollah in Lebanon across their border, then the regime will say, oh, the Houthis also. I don't want you to touch the Houthis. I don't want you to touch the militias, the Iranian, the Islamic regime militias in Iraq. And it could go all the way to, guess where, to Gaza, to Hamas. So the regime has no right to restrain Israel that is fighting its own enemies. But President Trump is telling them, no, we have not covered that. At the same time, he told Prime Minister Netanyahu to go easier at this point in time.
Hmm. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps murdered more than 30,000 of its own people before American and Israeli strikes began, Waleed. Iran has shut off the internet to virtually the entire population. Is there now a legitimate opening for the Iranian people to rise? What needs to happen now for a real revolution to occur? And remember, these people are unarmed.
You know, I don't want to say it's funny, but it's odd that the moment when they are ready, we are not inside. So for an Iranian revolution to win, you need to have both things. For the French resistance to win, they need to have a landing in Normandy, and both together have defeated the Nazis in France. So the regime knows what they're doing. They know that millions of Iranians, not tens of thousands, millions will be ready to take to the streets, and tens of thousands will be ready to, if they are armed, to fight. That's why they reached out to the United States. Remember in the beginning of the dialogue between you and me, I said, well, the regime knew that if they don't now paralyze the American action or engage the American action, they know that their civilians, their people, will be armed and will attack. See, these are the two points that we need to be very, very focusing on. Should we arm the Iranian people? Should we give them the legitimacy? I vote that yes, that's the only way to make sure that the regime will go down. The only way.
Hmm. If this regime falls, who or what fills the vacuum, Waleed? I mean, last time we saw this kind of power collapse in the region, we got ISIS. So we know Iran is not Iraq, but it has 70, 80 million people, a sophisticated, educated class, a diaspora. What does a post-Islamic Republic Iran look like? And is there a plan for peace?
I would say with confidence that 80% of these 90 million people are against the regime. They're not necessarily for somebody against somebody else. Then they will divide into political parties. We know that there are some leaders other than others who have the confidence or the vote of the people. There are also ethnic and religious minorities. Iran will become a diverse, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. But the regime is not going to go down that easily. It's going to probably become like a militia like Hezbollah and go into war against the next government, which will be free, which will be pro-American, pro-Western. And yes, you're right, will be very modernizing with a return of a large segment of the Iranian diaspora, including from the United States.
There's an odd story that broke this week. According to reporting in the Free Press, senior Pentagon officials, including Undersecretary of War and Policy Elbridge Colby, held a closed-door meeting with Cardinal Christophe Pierre. Now, he was up until recently the papal nuncio to the U.S. And in that meeting, officials allegedly said, America has the military power to do whatever it wants to in the world. The Catholic Church had better take its side, end quote. Then one official was said to have invoked the Avignon Papacy, which is the 14th century episode where the French monarchy used the threat of force to manipulate the Pope. Waleed, I want to ask you about this, but there's a bit of clarity that just dropped. Ambassador Brian Birch, who is Trump's ambassador to the Vatican, just posted this. I'm pleased to speak today with His Eminence Cardinal Christophe Pierre. As expected, he confirmed the recent media characterizations of his meeting with Undersecretary Colby are fabrications and were just invented. My question is, what do you make of this whole episode, Waleed? And this diplomatic gambit, I guess what emerges to my mind is it shows the Vatican is still a relevant player here and that they went out to the Vatican to seek their counsel.
Absolutely. Actually, I'll start with the last point you made even before I am part of this interview. The United States government, this administration in particular, is a conservative administration and it includes prayer. You know, openly, actually, for anybody who wants the Pentagon everywhere else. So there is no reason to imagine other than a fabrication, as we heard from you right now. And behind the fabrication, you could find a lot of the far left, a lot of the supporters of the Iran deal, those who want to create a wedge between the Catholic Church and also the United States, knowing that we have millions and millions of Catholics here. Millions among them are serving in our armed forces. So this looks like a manipulated matter to create that wedge between the two parties. But the two parties are smart enough, old enough, especially the Vatican, to understand what's going on.
Yeah, I didn't quite buy this story the way it was reported, because there was a alleged journalist, a guy who's run for office as a Democrat, who was kind of legitimizing this story. And I thought, look, you're always in a bad position when you're trying to align papal teaching with a particular policy prescription. The church will always be at odds with either party on policy. The church sets forth a moral high ground, an ideal that is to be observed, and both parties are going to fail to meet it in every way. But you need that moral ideal advanced. And I always worry when people try to, you know, turn the Pope into a partisan on one side or the other. There was a story today that he met, you know, he ran over his time in a private meeting with David Axelrod, the Democratic strategist under Obama. You know, what that means, I don't know. But there are some trying to say, oh, look, he's taking his marching orders. I take all of that with a grain of salt. But look, in the U.S., there's a controversy in Florida over a proposed domestic terrorism bill. The Council on American Islamic Relations, CARE, has organized protests against it. They're saying such a bill would create a police state. Waleed, you've written extensively on CARE, its origins, the relationship to the Muslim Brotherhood. What exactly is this Florida legislation? And does CARE's opposition to domestic terrorism protection cause you concern?
Well, of course, I am among the first ones since the 90s I had encounters with that organization called CARE, which in fact is a front to the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're not shy to say that. CARE has been trying to obstruct any awareness by the American people, including all religions, about jihadism. They want to cover up jihadism. I tried in my first book, post 9/11 book, to say, well, jihadism is an ideology. We're not dealing with theologies. Nobody's in America. The majority are not, you know, about this this religion or the other religion, but CARE is. Mm-hmm. CARE is guys fighting a battle along with the Islamists across the United States to legitimize the jihadists. They are the ones who are pushing for charge of Islamophobia. Islamophobia is a weapon by the jihadists to stop the critique of these jihadists. So what happened is that in Florida, and I think in Texas as well, the authorities, the government, the local state, have realized the threat of the expansion of that ideology. And that's why they have these legislations, and that's why CARE is opposing them.
Before we run out of time, Waleed, when the clock runs out, on the 2 weeks that we are now in the middle of, this 2 week ceasefire, what are the things necessary for stability in Iran? And is there a genuine off-ramp that ends in freedom for the Iranian people?
I know how the Iranian people are going to rise, will rise, and will defeat the regime. I know that we have the capabilities of helping them. What I don't know now at this point in your show, how we're going to build that bridge. At this point in time, we have allowed the Islamic regime in Iran to take time. How long that time would be before we discover, all of us, including our administration, our Congress, that they are playing, that they are maneuvering, that length of time is what would worry me.
Okay. Waleed Farah, always enlightening. You can catch the War and Freedom podcast at War Freedom on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts, Waleed. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Raymond.
He's one of the most tenacious defenders of Catholics in the public square, president of the Catholic League, and his newest book, Christianity in the Crosshairs, are at bookstores right now. He's here tonight to weigh in on a controversy that's erupted online involving the Netflix series The Sandman. There's a provocative scene involving a pope and a Vatican cardinal. Please welcome back to the program, Dr. Bill Donahue. Bill, the streaming series on Netflix, The Sandman, is based on Neil Gaiman's comic, and it features a scene that has really caused a lot of alarm. In its second season, which actually began airing back in July, there are characters disguised as the pope and a Vatican cardinal, and they engage in a provocative embrace and a kiss. The clip has suddenly gone viral just in time for Holy Week. Now, these are not characters in the show. They're actually the Norse trickster Loki and the Shakespearean mischief maker Puck in disguise. Before we get to the timing of all this, what do you make of the narrative framing that these are trickster characters wearing papal vestments to sow chaos inside the Vatican?
Well, they can spin it any way they want. It's all about really just trying to insult Catholics. But, you know, there's a certain banality to this. I mean, quite frankly, it's getting very boring. I mean, what do we have now? A bunch of little homosexual boys and girls sitting around giggling about this? I mean, nobody, everyone else has gone way past this. On the other hand, I have to say, they don't choose any other religion to try and play these games with and then try and spin it. We're not really talking about your clerics. We know what's going on. There's a fascination with sex in Hollywood and in the entertainment industry is in general. They keep saying Catholics are hung up on sex. We're not hung up on sex. Those guys are hung up on sex. So this is another kind of really rather stupid way of trying to say this is we're going to please our audience, which tells me something about the juvenile mentality of the people who watch these shows.
I mean, Bill, if this scene had depicted figures in Islamic dress or the vestments of a rabbi behaving this way, would that scene have survived a network pitch meeting or made the cut to air?
Well, given the hatred of Jews in this country today, it might. But Muslims, no way in the world would they ever go, would they ever put up with that. And, you know, the thing is that we Catholics and Jews, we're insulted all the time, but we don't use violence as a threat, or we don't engage in it either, against people who insult us. But that's not true of other faiths. And the people know that, and they play off of it. But as I say, it's gotten rather boring. I mean, this stuff was kind of jazzy maybe 20 years ago. But even here at the Catholic League, I just look at this. I just kind of roll my eyes. I'm saying, is that all you got? Mm.
Yeah. Well, as far as the timing, though, this clip was circulated through Netflix's own promotional channel, apparently, Bill. So Netflix chose to put this imagery in front of their marketing at Easter time, even though the series actually premiered last summer. What does that tell you about the intent?
Well, the fact that they chose Easter time is very clear. I mean, they don't choose Ramadan to go after Muslims. They don't go after Muslims at Christmas time, never mind during Ramadan. They don't go after Jews on the Day of Atonement, at Yom Kippur, and for that matter, throughout most of the year. Now, this is always, I keep saying to people, none of this is by accident. There's no conspiracy here. They know what they're doing, and we know what we're doing. Just people, open your eyes. This is a way of insulting Catholics because they don't like our teachings on women and sexuality. And we can go right down the same old tired laundry list. It's a wonder why is everybody joining the Catholic Church these days? Why aren't they running away from it? Why aren't they joining into the mainline Protestant denominations, which have given all these people at Netflix everything they want on sexuality and the like? You know, it's really, maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's anger that's driving them. Maybe they see the numbers and people are flocking to Catholicism and not to Satanism and not to radical secularism. I don't know what's inside their head, but their thinking is really bizarre.
The author Neil Gaiman, who built this Sandman show, the comic it's based on, he draws on various mythologies, Norse and Greek and Egyptian. Yet it seems the Catholic Church is an available target here. And my question is, given that Neil Gaiman's personal exploits, you know, he was himself charged, allegedly, with sexually abusing a number of women who've come forward. They canceled the show. This is the last season of that show because of his exploits. And yet you get these images coming through to market it.
Well, maybe he's working through his own demons. I don't know. I mean, look, we know what happened with Corey Feldman and everybody else. Amy Berg made a movie about molesting priests, and she had no problem getting distributed. She made a movie about molesters in Hollywood, and nobody would pick it up. I mean, the two-faced hypocrisy of Hollywood, I mean, it's not even a debatable subject. I think a lot of these people, I've certainly looked at a number of ex-Catholics, including ex-Catholic priests, by the way. It was a Jesuit priest who founded Catholics for Choice back in the 1970s. A lot of these people really do have their own demons, and they're kind of working it out. It's kind of an expiation, and they're trying to, you know, it's a reverse kind of projection. But I hope they get the help that they need. But I think a lot of it is driven by the fact that we've got good news going on in the Catholic Church, and so they want to try to hurt us. Yeah, well, they got to do a little better than this.
Yeah. Before we go, you recently wrote an open letter to Senator Cory Booker, and you sent it to every member of the United States Senate. The senator appeared on Fox News's special report with Bret Baier on April 6th, and he accused ICE agents of, quote, dragging Americans out of church. Bill, you had a pointed response, and when a U.S. senator deploys that kind of accusation without evidence, what is the cause?
I was watching that show at home. And I nearly fell off my chair that he's able to get away with this. I decided to do the research myself, got in early the next morning. And, of course, you can go into a church in the public area in the back. You can't go into the private area. I knew that nobody has been dragged out of church. I just knew that. But it wasn't good enough for me just kind of like intuitively to know it. I needed the facts. So I did the research on this. There's only one place in the United States that argued this. And that was the former Daily Worker, the public arm of the media arm of the Communist Party of the United States. It's now called People's World. And I used to debate these people. And they came out and said, yes, the ICE agents are dragging people out of church. I read the article. They didn't give one example where anyone was dragged out of church. They're talking about people, you know, mowing lawns on a church, or people walking, running across a parking lot, and things of that nature. So they lie about it, but they lie about it with alacrity, and people believe it. The Senator Booker is a prominent member of the Democratic Party. He's a presidential aspirant. The man is an absolute liar, and I've called him out on this. If they think that I'm wrong, then show me the evidence. Either that or then shut up. because what he's doing, he's demonizing ICE agents. He's also undermining his own credibility. And he's trying to frighten Americans into thinking that you, if you go to church on Sunday, next thing you know, some goon's going to come over there and lasso you. I find it despicable. And as a veteran, too, I also take offense at this nonstop assault on law enforcement, not just because I'm a Catholic, but also as a veteran. And people like Cory Booker should know better.
One last issue, Bill. You wrote a column recently on pacifism titled, "Is Pacifism Moral?" And you conclude, well, I won't run ahead to that, but the timing of this I found interesting since Pope Leo has been very vocal of late, calling all nations to lay down their arms. Why is that a problem?
Because of the mismessaging that's taking place. We believe in the just war doctrine. And even the Pope came out on March the 1st and he said that the only way to bring about peace is through negotiation. That's not true. We had wars. We have many wars that bring about peace. Now, negotiation is always preferable to violence. Everybody understands that. But don't tell us that the only way is. And so I look at what St. Augustine said. I look at what the Catholic Catechism said. I look at what Pope John Paul II said. I've looked at the church documents, and they all argue that it is necessary at times for national defense and for self-defense to protect yourself. And sometimes you have to go to war. Mm-hmm. All those people are not wrong. In fact, they're all right. And I mentioned in my piece that I was lectured to with hundreds of other Catholic professors sitting there when some Quaker from Carnegie Mellon University spoke to us and said that we had an immoral religion because he was a pacifist. And if we followed their teachings, we wouldn't have any problems. And I put up my hand. I said, I got something to say to you. I said, none of us would be alive in this room today had it not been for the army back in World War II rejecting everything you've said. We're alive today because men and women picked up arms and defended the country. And that was dead silence in the place. The guy had no rebuke, could say nothing. I don't need to be lectured. When these people are talking about pacifism and they would allow innocent women and children, non-combatants to die, when they could take out the enemy, they are the immoral ones, and they don't believe in peace. I believe in peace. Sometimes you have to fight for it. They believe in surrender. There's a big difference between peace and surrender, and I hate their self-righteousness.
Bill Donahue, never, never at a loss for words and always bringing the fight. Thank you for being here. Christianity in the Crosshairs by Bill Donahue is available now at bookstores everywhere online, as well as EWTN's catalog. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you so much.
Pope Leo XIV is making an apostolic journey to Africa from April 13th to the 23rd. The trip will focus on peace and supporting marginalized communities. This will be the first ever papal visit to Algeria, a mostly Muslim nation with a tiny Catholic community. What should we be looking for and what should we focus on as Leo's visit unfolds? Here with a preview is the senior Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register, Edward Penton. Ed, good to see you. Happy Easter.
Pope Leo will take
10 days to visit four countries on this historic visit to Africa. Give us the lay of the land. Where is he going and why is he going to those places and nations?
Right, Raymond. Well, he's going to Algeria, Cameroon, followed by Angola and Equatorial Guinea from April the 13th to the 23rd. It's his longest trip so far. It's not that long compared to other previous popes. Of course, John Paul had trips that lasted 15 to 20 days. This will last 11 days. But his primary, I suppose, the most important visit in his sense, I suppose you could say, is Algeria, in the sense that it's where St. Augustine was born, of course. He's an Augustinian, Pope Leo. So he'll be going there. That's a very significant part of the trip. He'll be visiting Annaba, which is where Hippo used to be. And he'll be visiting the archaeological sites there and celebrating Mass there as well in the Basilica of St. Augustine. But the primary purpose of the trip, as you said, is really to highlight peace, justice and development in these countries, and also Catholic-Muslim dialogue, while meeting, obviously, the political and church leaders across the four countries, as he always does, as the popes always do in these trips, and also the laity and religious as well.
Yeah. Well, Africa is certainly the most rapidly growing region of the Catholic Church globally. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, by some projections, more Catholics will live in sub-Saharan Africa by 2,100 than exist in the entire world today. Ed, what signal is Pope Leo sending, do you think, about where he sees the future of the church through this visit?
Yes, well, it's interesting. Matteo Bruni said today, the Vatican spokesman, that the trip, the focus on Africa is really because it's sometimes forgotten. The continent's often forgotten at a time when reaching out to this continent and listening to its concerns can be of great value, he said. And also because there are certain examples coming from these countries in particular of coexistence and how they can have victory really through peaceful negotiations and mediation after conflicts. They've all had conflicts in one way or another. And so they've all come through the other side, although Cameroon is still suffering very much from internal disputes and conflicts there. But otherwise, I think there's a great sense that there's a lot of a good example that these countries can give of overcoming conflicts in these conflict zones.
Well, we've seen African bishops emerge over the last few years as some of the most doctrinally traditional voices in the church, particularly on issues like marriage and family and sexuality and the limits of enculturation. The American Bishops, the African Bishops Conference recently issued a document firmly rejecting polygamy as incompatible with sacramental marriage. Ed, what is the dynamic between Leo and the African hierarchy? And is he going there to affirm them and their theological traditionalism in some ways?
That's quite possible, Raymond. There wasn't much talk about that from Matteo Bruni today in the press conference, but he did stress that family, the importance of family, will certainly be a key issue that Pope Leo will raise. But yes, certainly the African continent, the church in Africa is very much conservative in terms of moral teaching. And so that is likely to be something that will be at the forefront of what's discussed. He's going to give many discourses during this trip and celebrate eight masses. So there'll be plenty of opportunity for him in homilies and messages to get those points across.
Ed, China has deep economic influences across Africa. I mean, there's ongoing violent conflicts in several nations. The Pope has already been extraordinarily vocal about what he calls wars of aggression and the globalization of indifference. How much of this trip do you think is pastoral, and how much will carry diplomatic and geopolitical weight?
I think, like most of these trips, Raymond, it'll be half and half. It'll be very much pastoral, but also there'll be issues raised about politics, especially to do with corruption, of course, as well, because that's a big issue in some of these countries. But also one aspect we haven't talked about yet is the interfaith dialogue, which is also key to these countries, particularly Algeria, and the Christian-Muslim relations. It's interesting that although it's the 30th anniversary this year of the martyrdoms of the seven Trappists in Algeria who were martyred there by Islamists, he won't actually be visiting the monastery there, which has caused some discussion. Apparently, the Holy See hasn't even inquired about that. There was a question at the press conference today whether the Algerian government had blocked the Holy See from making a trip to the monastery, but Matteo Bruni wouldn't answer that question. He said he had nothing more to say about it. But it's also interesting that he will be visiting the Grand Mosque of Algiers, which is quite a contrast that he won't be visiting this monastery or these other places where 19 martyrs died in Algeria in the 1990s. So there it's not just Tiberine, which is where this monastery is. There are other places too where he won't be going. So that's a bit of a question mark. Matteo Bruni said, well, there are many Muslims were killed in the 90s too. And so, but it is rather odd that I think some people think that he's not going to visit these places and pay homage to them. But anyway, that's all we know so far.
Ed, what are the two or three moments that you will be most closely watching as this journey unfolds? And what events, in your estimation, will be the most revealing about the direction of Leo's pontificate?
Yes, well, I think it'll be interesting to see his visits to St. Augustine's birthplace. I think that'll be, very, very interesting, especially for him and the sort of Augustinian heritage there. But also, I think also the masses, the homilies, what he's going to say, what he's going to focus on there, I think is something to watch. I think these issues are very much of concern to him. Of course, migration is going to be important to him. here and these kind of issues. But yes, as you say, it'll be interesting to see whether he'll bring up particularly the sort of the moral teachings and how much he'll discuss that, you know, the marriage and the family over there because of these key issues, you know, especially related to polygamy too.
Right.
So I think these are all going to be focus aspects to focus on, but we'll have to see. It's going to be an interesting trip, certainly.
Before we run out of time. Yeah, I can't believe we're only a few weeks away from the first anniversary of Leo's election. We were there during that conclave that elected Pope Leo. He has chosen not to come to the United States, which is significant since it is America's 250th anniversary this year. He's going to Africa instead as his first international journey. What is the Pope's itinerary here and his choosing Africa first tell us about who he is and where he, what he intends to do as Pope?
Well, I think it goes back to what you were saying earlier, that it is the fastest growing continent, the fastest growing area in the world where for the church. So I think that's a key part for him, that it's the most growing, it's the most vibrant Catholic continent, if you like. And so I think that's the key part of the key reason why he's going. But yes, it is interesting that he's not chosen to go to the United States, at least not yet, but he is choosing Africa. Pope Francis, too, and previous popes seem to have a great love for Africa and the fact that the faith is so alive there. So I think that is a key reason for why he's going.
Well, Edward, we will leave it there, and we'll continue to follow your excellent reporting. You can find Edward's reporting on X at Edward Penton and at ncregister.com. Thank you, Ed.
Thank you, Raymond.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with my pal Shannon Bream. We had a moving conversation, an inspiring one, about faith, suffering, and perseverance, and how God was the key in her life to overcoming some of life's toughest moments. Watch. Talk to me about the presence of God in that suffering, because that's really what the new book is about. Mm-hmm. The presence of God, and how do you find it in suffering and not despair?
Mm-hmm. It's that still, small voice. It's just pouring out your heart. He already knows how much you're struggling, the pain that you're in. It's not going to shock him or scare him off.
Yeah.
I mean, he wants to sit with you in that. And the beautiful thing about Christ is that obviously he came and took on the human mantle, fully God, fully man. So he knows what it's like to suffer. Mm-hmm. He's not oblivious to that. He's not so immune from that he doesn't know what it's like to be in physical and emotional pain.
Talk to me about confidence, because you write in the book that the solution to self-confidence, the answer is not more confidence.
Right.
What is it?
Yeah. It's more dependence, which is completely flies in the face of what the world would tell us today.
Yeah.
It is more about you. Hype yourself up, get more likes, be the brand, do all of these things. Yeah. But that's so antithetical to what God calls us to. I think he makes us so that we are dependent. We need to be dependent on him. On him to get anything done. And that's why I think he uses such flawed, broken people, because in the end, it can't be about them. It's got to be about God.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Shannon Bream is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss an Arroyo Grande episode. And it's free. And of course, be on the lookout for Friday's installment of the Prayerful Posse. We talk about the Pope's war stance and that Netflix sacrilege and much more. Go to Arroyo Grande Show wherever you get your podcasts. Canada is closing in on 100,000 state-assisted deaths, if you can believe it. That's more than all the Canadians who fell in battle in World War II. In Australia, a woman made history by donating her organs after taking her own life. And in Spain, a 25-year-old woman who was not terminally ill won a court battle for the right to be euthanized. The culture of death is spreading at an alarming rate. Here with analysis of these stories and more, neuroscientist and senior ethicist at the National Catholic Bioethics Center, Father Tad Poholjik. Father Tad, so great to see you. This Canadian story is very distressing to me. Canada's Medical Assistance in Dying program, they call it MAID, is approaching 100,000 state-assisted deaths. Some 45 Canadians are now being euthanized every single day, Father. How did Canada get to this point from a narrowly passed law in 2016, which we talked about at the time, to what amounts to nationalized death machines in less than a decade?
Yeah, so I think it's remarkable. You mentioned MAID. These acronyms kind of drive me a little bit crazy. Also talk about VAD, voluntary assisted dying. And it's like, oh, voluntary. Oh, it's voluntary, therefore it's okay. You know, all of these acronyms are sort of trying to prepackage a conclusion that something wrong is actually okay. And, you know, my favorite one, though, I think you're going to be bringing this up about some of these individuals who are mentally ill, and they go and they request from the Canadian authorities to be euthanized, and this is sometimes permitted. Somebody came up with this brilliant phrase that I really like, medical homicide as psychotherapy.
Hmm. So, yeah, that's really what it amounts to. I mean, when you break it down, look, critics of MAID's expansion, Father, they warned from the very beginning that eligibility criteria would creep to include terminal illness, chronic conditions, and mental illness. We see that in the case of that 26-year-old man who was approved for MAID because of diabetes, vision problems, and seasonal depression. His mother said she never thought any doctor would approve a 22-year-old for assisted suicide due to blindness. Well, is this not part the slippery slope that the church was warning about?
Oh, totally. Totally. And, you know, the way this is marketed, as you're aware, is to say, oh, don't worry, we have all kinds of controls in place. You have to go through review boards. You've got to get, you know, second opinions from physicians. And it just goes on and on. But the reality is that as soon as you put any waiting periods in, they immediately expand it and say, no, you don't have to wait a month to do this. You can get it in 2 weeks. You can get it in a week if you're, you know. And so this is where we are. We are on the very slippery slope. And in one sense, you know, it might be pretty discouraging, I think, for people who have been watching the kind of march of an advance of death in such big societies as, you know, Canada and ours. But on the other hand, I was encouraged recently. Scotland turned away assisted suicide. They voted against it. There was a referendum that came up, and their members, you know, of the parliament voted it down. And then the other thing that impressed me was Slovenia, where Melania is from. They had legalized physician-assisted suicide. And then, believe it or not, they completely reversed it. And they had to go out, they had to gather, I don't know, it was 30,000 signatures. This was really hard to do. There's only 2 million people in that country. And they got it, and they reversed it. And now it's like, wow. So, you know, this is not some kind of hopeless prospect. We have to all understand this is a serious issue that calls for action, calls for commitment to reversing these types of pressures that are being applied to
us. Unless Americans think this is not happening here, it is. New York State just became the 14th state, the 14th, to pass a version of assisted suicide. The New York State Catholic Conference called it a warning, called Canada a warning, which and another stat I found so disturbing. In 2021, nearly 10,000 Canadians were euthanized. That same year, only 2,000 shelter dogs were put down there. Now, Father, what needs to be done to turn this around at this point? Is it too late for Canada? And will the U.S. eventually follow?
Well, you know, Canada is going to be a hard nut to crack, I'm convinced. It's, you know, it's gone pretty far down this road. And I think, but I do think something similar to, you know, what happened in Slovenia has to happen there. In the sense that what they did in Slovenia was that they got all the churches together and they said, will you guys support a referendum to overturn this unjust law? And then all the churches didn't sign up right away, but eventually they all got on board. Then they issued a common statement and then they issued shared prayers. It was remarkable. You know, it became a kind of groundswell. We need that kind of thing. We need some leadership and direction in Canada. Canada has, I think, a Catholic backbone still somewhere, you know. And so even though
let's hope they find it. Look, in Australia recently, a 55-year-old woman dying of motor neuron disease underwent voluntary assisted dying and simultaneously donated her lungs, kidneys, and heart valve. She's being called the first person in the world to self-administer an assisted dying substance and then donate her organs. Why does the sequencing of these two decisions matter so profoundly, Father? And isn't this just another example of incentivizing death?
Absolutely. The incentivizing piece is there. It's like, look, if I can get some good out of this, mm-hmm. help someone else. And she made this very argument as she was carrying it out. You know, yeah. she jumped into a limousine with her two dogs and with her two daughters, went to the hospital, took the poison, killed herself, and then her organs were extracted. Raymond, this is so common sense. Anybody who proposes suicide as a way to get organs, it has to be an absolute exclusion, red line that cannot be crossed. And those organ procurement organizations and other groups that are involved with the process need to really come out and say, this is unacceptable. This is not a way to get organs.
No, it's immoral. It's immoral and it's macabre. In Spain last month, a 25-year-old woman named Noelia Castillo, who was a paraplegic after a suicide attempt following a brutal assault, won a legal battle against her own father for the right to euthanasia under Spain's 2021 law. She was not terminally ill, Father. The U.S. State Department, by the way, is actually reviewing her case as a potential human rights violation. But when a young woman in despair is granted death rather than an option of healing, what has gone wrong with our understanding of human dignity?
Yeah, and what has gone wrong with the medical system? Because I think in a lot of places you feel like, gee, we've got to wait forever to see a specialist for my particular cancer or my particular heart disease or whatever. Wouldn't it just be easier and cheaper, heck of a lot cheaper to, you know, these drugs to kill yourself for a few hundred bucks? And I think that the number crunchers are aware of this, and there's real pressure here to, make a quick exit. And this is unjust all the way up and down. The financial piece is real. In Slovenia, they used this, again, as an argument, and people were like, yeah, we've seen that. We've seen how inaccessible our own healthcare system can be. And how expensive. And so obviously there's this real pressure. So
well, this is why everybody's marked, Father. Everybody, not only the frail elderly, all of us, you know, no matter the condition we might find ourselves in, there is economic pressure to get rid of you quickly so as not to expend any funds in the health system, no matter where you are.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, you're pointing out so correctly that the disabled have a big target right on their back, and they know it. The disabled from the beginning of all of this have been saying, this whole idea of physician-assisted suicide or active euthanasia is just a total crock, and we're going to be caught in the crossfire of this. And they are. Yeah. They know it because they're not productive enough, supposedly. You know, here I am in my wheelchair, not doing much for the good of others, and so you can relegate me. And it's like, no, you're valuable, you're beautiful, you're important. Everyone with a disability is here for a reason in our Lord's beautiful plan. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I just think that's a message we've got to work on.
Yeah, when I hear these stories and read them, I think, you know, look, we're all one false step on a curb or a slip out of the bed from being in that same position. So lest you sit there, oh, well, I'm fine. No, you're not. It can happen like that. We've seen it. Here's a deeply disturbing story out of Switzerland, Father. A 64-year-old American woman became the first person to use a suicide pod, and she died in a Swiss forest last year. Now, the pod is meant to flood the lungs with nitrogen gas. It's supposedly a peaceful and painless death. But a postmortem found unexplained strangulation marks on her neck. The doctor on the scene was overheard on a phone call saying she's still alive. Father, what does this train wreck of a story tell us about the fantasy of a mechanized, distant, peaceful, solitary death? And is the church doing enough to oppose this kind of outfit and approach?
Well, I think it's a reminder that once you have yielded on the initial breaks on this, it's just a free fall. It really is. And, you know, there's fascinating data where they interview those who do euthanasia in the Netherlands, and they ask the doctors, they say, hey, have you ever killed somebody who did not ask you to kill them? You know, no consent. And the doctors are assured your answers will be kept confidential. And they say, oh, yeah, I've done it many times. So, you know, your story about the sarcopod and somebody maybe coming in and strangling her afterwards, you know, one sees an immediate, powerful devaluation of the incredible, beautiful gift of human life. And it just, it spins laterally out of control.
Well, and like something out of Agatha Christie, you know, I'm being told that after that attack, and it looks like it, allegedly the doctor strangled her, that doctor then committed suicide. I mean, this is the problem with the culture of death. It breeds more death, and there's nothing good to be had there. A startup company, I'm going to end with this, in Richmond, California, R3 Bio, that's been operating in secrecy for years, has admitted to raising money to create non-sentient monkey organ sacs as an alternative to animal testing. MIT Technology Review reports that the founder has also pitched what he called brainless human clones, Father. So the idea would be you grow a copy of yourself without a functional cortex, you keep it alive on life support, and you harvest its organs when you need them. What is the Catholic teaching here, Father? Shouldn't there be moral and ethical limits on these kind of technological ambitions?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Raymond, this goes back to discussions you and I had 20 years ago about therapeutic cloning. You may remember the idea there was, hey, create an embryo that's a match to me or to you, grow it a little bit, and then kill it for its stem cells and use those stem cells to make organs. So same idea, just coming back in a different form. And the problem, there are additional problems with this proposal, which is that if you make these organ sacs of human beings, you are going to have to gestate them somehow. So they're talking about, you know, surrogacy, having women carry these creatures, you know, without a brain. And maybe even then some of the ones that would be produced could themselves become surrogates for further surrogates down, you know, the road.
Wow.
So it just gets macabre and bizarre as people, you know, I think at the end of the day, what's the pressure here? It's a sense of, hey, I don't ever want to die. I want to find a way here to live forever, which is a good aspiration, but you got to be very careful about the means that you choose to pursue that. And people are not being very circumspect or careful in that regard. They're just running after whatever. And in a sense, idolizing you know, science and transhumanism and the powers of medicine in ways that they really shouldn't requires greater circumspection.
Father Tad, we could have called this segment Dr. Frankenstein Ain't Got Nothing on Us, but we'll leave it there for the moment. Father Tad Boholczyk, thank you so much for being with us. And his commentary can be found at National Catholic Bioethics Center at their website, ncbcenter.org. Father Tad, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Raymond. Always a pleasure for me as well.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.